and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. When a country loses a war, the winner dictates the peace terms. This is abundantly clear in the Memorandum of Understanding. The U.S. and Israel still can't comprehend Iran won this war of choice. Also, despite the media hype of Ukraine is winning, the reality is time is running out for Kiev and its Western backers. Discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Tariq Cyril Amar in Istanbul. He's a historian and political commentator, and George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Tariq in Istanbul. You know, as we speak, the talks in Geneva started. Luminaries such as Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff representing the United States, which incidentally, gentlemen, they're both being roasted severely in Israel for betraying their people. Okay, so all of this is caving in on everyone here. But Tariq, you know, we can go through all of the issues of is the Strait of Hormuz open or closed? We can talk about Lebanon, which is obviously very important. But when I look at this 60-day period and considering who wrote the Memorandum of Understanding, obviously the vast majority of it was written by the Iranians, because it's an echo of what we saw in something that we saw in April. I look at this as kind of a probation period for the United States. It's basically, can you measure up? Can you actually negotiate? And I think that's the kind of attitude that the Iranians are taking. I mean, you have to have some kind of trust. So this is a period of trust building, if that's even possible. Your take?
My take is that the Iranians are probably consciously dealing with a problem that the whole world has, which is that, strictly speaking, you cannot trust the United States at all, and you cannot trust Israel at all. And the complex that they both form, the symbiotic thing, even if they're sometimes having conflicts like now, you can't trust that either. So I don't think it's a period of trust building, because the Iranians would be very foolish to trust the United States really ever, and certainly not within 60 days, right? A lot would have to be happening in the United States to earn trust, actual trust. But having said that, I'm not with those people who basically stop there and say, well, you cannot trust the United States ever. They break all agreements. Everything is always just a preparation for the next aggression, which is all true. And then say, therefore, you should never make an agreement. That is actually not true, because it's not intelligent. I think the Iranians are solving the problem of making agreements with people who cannot be trusted at all. That may work for them. It may not work for them. It may be that even now, the White House is already planning to attack again, for instance, after the midterms. That may be one scenario, right? It may be that the Israeli hold on the White House is ultimately, forget J.D. Vance and all that theater, strong enough to reverse it all even more quickly. Who knows? But it is something that the Iranian leadership has to decide. They have to work with this. I will make one historical comparison, which is Lenin was right to do Brest-Litovsk in March 1918, although it was a crappy, crappy, crappy deal indeed. And a lot of people around Lenin inside the Bolshevik leadership were not at all satisfied and said, you can't do this. The Germans are really destroying us with this. And they were. But then 6 months later, the Germans are gone, right? So it plays out differently. I personally think Tehran is right. And there's one more point I would make. Tehran has now a record of outplaying the United States and Israel. They have that already. You can argue in this round, and we don't know about the next one, but it has to be acknowledged that they've outplayed them. They are the better chess players. So maybe trust them a little bit to get it right, whatever they do next.
Yeah, because, George, I mean, it's still worth the effort, okay? I mean, if there's even a remote chance to come to some kind of understanding, I don't think it's ever going to get to the point of a treaty. I don't think there's going to be mutual diplomatic recognition. I think that's way, way down a field if it's ever going to happen at all. But it is still worth the effort. And we still see so much confusion coming out of the White House. There will be no tolls on the Strait of to Hormuz, except for maybe the United States will charge one. I mean, this is it's quite maddening. But I think Tariq is right. I mean, there's so many stereotypes in the West about the Iranians, the Persians. But one thing is for sure, they're tenacious and they're very patient, George.
Yes, I think so. And they've shown themselves to be, I think, as Tariq put it very well, better chess players than the United States has shown itself to be. And so I think it does make sense to continue with the negotiation process and see whether the United States is taking it seriously or not. And I think that will become very clear. Was this something that Trump and the and Vance and the rest of them just cooked up in order to get Trump off the hook and then basically kick the can down the road until the midterms and then afterwards start the whole thing up again? Or was this a serious venture? Does the United States intend, essentially, which is what's in this memorandum of understanding, does the United States intend to develop a working relationship with Iran? You know, you don't have to like Iran, you don't have to like the Iranian government, but are you prepared to move towards a detente? In the case of the JCPOA, it was clear that the Obama administration wasn't prepared to do that. It was a very narrowly focused agreement. In the memorandum of understanding suggests that this time the United States intends to move towards a rapprochement, towards some kind of a detente. So I think it makes sense. Begin this negotiation process and see what the United States intends. Now, there's a lot of minefields down the road. Obviously, Israel and Lebanon, I mean, we've already seen that Israel has already said, we're not part of it. Oh, yeah, well, we've got a ceasefire agreement with Hezbollah. No, we don't have a ceasefire agreement. And then, of course, you have that $350 billion fund. That would be very nice. Does the United States really intend to go through with that? History suggests that the United States never gives any money to anybody. I mean, it's always promised money. Oh, we'll give reconstruction aid and so on. That money never materializes. So there's that. And then there's of course, the sanctions. And the United States record on lifting sanctions is very, very patchy. Obama didn't do it, other than the UN Security Council resolution. But this memorandum of understanding is explicit. All sanctions, including the IAEA sanctions, all of them will be lifted. So we'll see how far the U.S. really intends to go down that road.
You know, Tariq, one of the things, obviously, what's getting so much attention is the so-called tension between Trump and Netanyahu. Now, we've been through this for a long time. I've passed off most of it on just theater. But there is... I mean, if Trump wants his vision, if we can actually even use that term, of getting himself, this is an off-ramp for him. I mean, he doesn't care about war or peace or anything. No, he wants out of this mess, okay? And one of the biggest obstacles is Israel. Now, we've had a lot of commentary coming from Trump himself, and particularly J.D. Vance. Now, I don't, you know, what has it been called? It's being called despecializing the relationship. Obviously, a reference to the special relationship with Israel. Is that necessary for this, for Trump to get anything remotely close to getting off the hook, getting his off ramp?
Yes, to a very practical extent. Like, taking a step back from whatever J.D. Vance or others are saying, which is one thing, but there is a practical issue, which is, I think it is clear enough that the Israeli leadership really doesn't like this MOU and what would happen if that policy actually succeeds and continues on the side of the United States. I think that dislike of the Israeli leadership is genuine. They hate it. And I think that's not theater. So in practical terms, if Trump and his White House stick to this MOU and its policy, they have to an extent alienate Israel. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, despecializing is a very peculiar term because this isn't even a special relationship. This is a sick pathological symbiosis. Right. And the United States has to find a way of cleaning that up, of becoming sovereign again as against Israel, which it is not. And of course, to do that would require so much more. The first step would be shut down AIPAC. literally, don't just finally force it to declare itself to be what it is, namely the most powerful lobby organization. APEC, after all, is a special case where you are the most powerful lobby organization in the country, but you don't fall under those regulations, right? So I'm not saying they should force APEC to declare itself. I think they should shut it down. When I see the United States shutting down APEC, I will take that as a serious sign of despecialization with Israel. There is so much more to be done.
Well, I mean, but Teddy, I mean, something as simple as, let me throw it to George right now, denying arms transfers. I mean, and you can have a very specific thing. I mean, we saw what you did in Gaza. You're doing it now in Lebanon. We do not accept that. I mean, And it maybe for a separate program, gentlemen, because now I'm trying to be sympathetic to what Trump is trying to do. This is how crazy the world we're in right now. Okay, I'm really angry that he started this whole thing, but I'm trying to hope that he can manage this. I mean, if he really is a leader and there's he is a masterful deal maker, he has to do it now, George.
He absolutely does have to. And it is remarkable the things that both Trump and J.D. Vance have been saying just in recent days. You had J.D. Vance saying, well, Israel, I mean, you're bad-mouthing the president of the United States. He's pretty much the only friend you've got. You can take him out of the picture. You don't have any friends at all in the world. That's a kind of remarkable statement. And then some of the things that Trump said in his news conference in France earlier last week, when he said, why don't we stop sending Israel to fight Hezbollah? Why don't we send our guy, the Al-Qaeda guy, Jolani? I think he would do a better job than Israel. He'd probably be more humane. He wouldn't just take down buildings and kill everybody who's living in the building.
Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, that's Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is more humane than Israel. That was Trump who said that. So when you've gone that far, how much further do you need to go to say, you're basically living off us. You're pursuing policies that are detrimental to us. If you're going to take our money, if you're going to take our arms, the minimum that we can expect from you is that you follow our lead. You actually pursue our interests that are in accord with ours. And that's something is anathema to Israel. But of course, it has happened in the past that presidents have taken on the Israel lobby and have prevailed. Obama came under enormous attack from Netanyahu. He went through with the JCPOA. He didn't go as far as he could and should have done. It's within Trump's power to do so. The question is then, is he really willing to take the risk, or are there all sorts of other political considerations that he has to take into account, such as his own maybe legal liabilities down the road, that will prevent him from actually taking on this lobby?
Yeah, and if he succeeds, then it would be the beginning of the end of the Greater Israel project, which would be a historic achievement. Before we go to the break, gentlemen, the presser that Trump gave at the end of G7, there will be doctoral dissertations written on that one speech alone. I watched it live, and I had so many different emotions. It was really, not only was it political theater, but it was history in the making. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're talking about some real news, and the real news right now, George, I wrote it all down because it's just kind of complicated, because there's so many acronyms and countries. Politico, our favorite to go for. You can mine Politico endlessly for information and propaganda. So I came across E3, E5, the EU... Then the European Council, the European Commission, Extended Action Service. Now, all of them want a piece of the action of should we talk to Russia or we shouldn't talk to Russia. I mean, if Europe is, facing an existential threat, why are they arguing about who's going to sit around the table, George?
Well, because what else are they going to talk about? Almost the entirety of the European Union is desperate to continue with this war in Ukraine. but they have to keep coming up with new justifications for keeping it going. So last week or whenever it was about the drones, Russia's attacking us with drones. We're under existential threat from the Russian drones. Then before that, it was, we're facing Russian invasion. Russia's going to invade Europe. We need to do something now. 2030, no, maybe 2029. No, maybe 2028.
Maybe this summer.
And then we have Ukraine is really doing poorly, so we have to do something to help out. So now they've come up with a new argument that they think will appeal to Donald Trump. This new argument is that Ukraine is winning. They just made this up out of whole cloth. You know, it was not based on any evidence whatsoever. Ukraine is winning. Russia's on the back foot. Russia's in desperate trouble. The economy is about to collapse. Putin is very, very unpopular in the country. All we need to do is just to give it, one more push. Let's give everything we have to Ukraine, and Ukraine will win. And then you have Emmanuel Macron, who says, Trump, when he first came to office, he thought that Russia's winning. He's now persuaded to our point of view, Ukraine is winning. So this is now the new rationale. But what is striking is that whenever you listen to these pronouncements, not one of them ever presents evidence. When you say Ukraine is winning, what are they winning? Where are they gaining any ground?
They're winning on X, I noticed. Okay.
Well, that's it. Yes. Yes.
I mean, because Tariq, I mean, if because of the algorithm, I get stuck with Applebaum and Sikorsky and all of that, McFowell nonstop. But, if I believe them, then I should be waiting for the Ukrainian tanks to be rolling across Red Square, because that's the impression you get from social media, Tariq.
Well, these people, Applebaum, Sikorsky, I guess Snyder is in there as well. They've been saying this from day one, and they will never stop saying it, until the end of days. But look, I think what is really happening is that there is a confusion that is willfully created between Ukraine landing certain strikes with long-range drones and some missiles inside Russian territory that do certain harm to the Russian energy industry. And from there, in an enormous leap of imagination, going to Ukraine is winning. And of course, what you have to do for this operation to work is you have to not look at the ground, and you have to not look at what Russia is doing in return. You don't have to look at demography and so on and so on and so on. But there is one serious issue I see here, right? On one side, this is a rhetorical strategy. Call it propaganda, and it's this X effects indeed. But on the other side, it might be a sign of something very serious, namely that I fear that in EU, NATO, Europe, there are quite a few people within the military and political elites whose dream is to keep Ukraine fighting and bleeding until in a few years they feel they can join the war themselves. I think this should not be underestimated. We have people now in Germany, it's very clear to me, who want a shooting direct war with Russia.
Yeah, but Tariq,
they're elsewhere too.
Yeah, but there's voluntary recruitment. Nobody wants to join the German army.
Yes, but be careful, Peter, because the same people are not naive. What they have already prepared, for instance, in Germany is the legal basis to force people. So it's a scenario for them. If you create an actual shooting war with Russia, then they have everything they need legally to start forcefully recruiting people. And these people, we look at Ukraine and what they're doing with people, kidnapping them on the street, and we are revolted. These guys are not revolted. They see Ukraine as an example in every respect, also in how you make people who don't want to fight, fight against their will. This is the serious aspect here. I think there's a very, very dangerous tendency now in Europe that considers war with Russia possible and desirable and wants to use Ukraine to gain a few more years and then join openly.
Yeah, well, so, you know, with that scenario, George, then you don't have to worry about elections very much, and you don't have to talk about, you know, left wing, right wing, you know, it's a, you know, it's militarism. I mean, I think Tariq is onto something. You and I have talked about this ad nauseum. I mean, this will be the reason why, a marketing term, reason why, is to fight Russia. It's not for prosperity. It's not for security. They found their mission for the European Union, infusing it with NATO. But if you look at, everybody knows I live in Moscow. I mean, what we see here is this terrorism, state terrorism against Russian civilians, against apartment buildings, against the dormitory. I mean, that wasn't a one-off hit. That was a targeted. I think there were 16 projectiles involved in that. That was intentional. Now, maybe it was the AI, but and that's going to be the great new excuse, the Nuremberg excuse. I was just following orders. I was just following AI is going to be the this century's mantra, but. You know, there's this misleading narrative, and Tariq alluded to it, you know, drones, missiles, and all that. Meanwhile, there's a ferocious battle going on the ground, a conventional battle in Ukraine, which the Ukrainians are losing day by day. Not very fast, but day by day.
No, the way that the Europeans, and to a lesser extent the Americans, are playing it is by essentially approving all of these attacks. I mean, yes, there are the attacks on the oil refineries, the oil storage depots, but there are also attacks on clearly civilian targets. When these things happen, these attacks on the civilian targets, then the Europeans just throw their hands up and say, well, we don't know what really happened. I mean, the Russians say this, the Ukrainians say something else. Who knows? Let's hold on.
Yeah, but when it happens in Romania, they know exactly what happened.
Exactly, and same with the fire on that the cathedral. Oh, obviously Russia was targeting the cathedral. Why they would target the cathedral doesn't matter. This is obviously what the Russians do. So this is how they play. They approve of anything at all that Ukraine does. Kill civilians? Good. Now, I do think that there are indeed elites, particularly within the military and intelligence and the security apparat, but also among the political class, that want a war with Russia. We see this all the time. You see German general, the top German general saying Germany is already ready, is already prepared to fight Russia.
Fight tonight.
You have British generals declaring that,
you must be talking about a computer simulation.
No,
really.
Yes, they're saying it on sort of June the 22nd. You know, that's the time. You had Merz saying the other day, well, you know, Russians traditionally have been very bad at offensive warfare. So you're saying, this is, are you serious? You know, they're bad? Who took Berlin? But, you know, the Russians have always been bad at offensive warfare, so we don't have to worry too much about that.
Well, no wonder he's the second worst chancellor in German history.
Okay. That's right. So now, The issue then is the recruitment. I mean, Tariq made the point that Germany has already laid down the kind of a constitutional legal framework to introduce conscription. But there's also another aspect in Europe, which is the migrant problem. There are an awful lot of migrants in Europe, a lot of people in Europe living illegally in Europe. They can certainly be recruited if there's a manpower shortage to fight Russia. So, hey, this could be your fast track towards legal status. So if the Europeans, and I think they may quite soon be ready to get involved in a war with Russia, I think there is a pool of manpower that they're going to draw on.
Yeah, gentlemen, I just have a hard time kind of squaring the circle here. You know, it's quite obvious they want the conflict in Ukraine to continue because they think that will bleed Russia. They don't really care much about Ukrainian life. But maybe Russia will give them the war they want. Tariq, what will they do then?
Yeah. Look, I personally hope that, that Russia will not fall into what I think would be a trap. I think there are people now, certainly in Berlin, who would welcome it if Russia actually attacked NATO territory, because that's a wet dream, because they would then have a pretext to go to war with Russia openly. I still think Russia is making the right decision to shy away from that, as hard as that may be as a restraint. Now, if that were to happen, and if there were an open shooting war with EU, NATO, Europe, the first question would be, would the Americans actually help the Europeans? Big question. The second question is, what would happen on the ground? Now, I am always astonished, because I'm a German, I'm really astonished to see how people have forgotten what war can feel like. There is a flippancy here, talking about, you know, what the priests would do, what the hospitals would do, what the truckers would do. It's almost told as a story of a big adventure, you know, the emergency of all emergencies. Hey, wouldn't it be interesting to test yourself in that? Within days, people in Europe would come to their limits for good reasons, because they would suffer mass casualties very quickly in such a war. And all the fun would cease very, very quickly. Of course, it would be a highly disruptive, catastrophic event. And it's very, very open who would be standing at the end of it. But obviously, it would also be an enormous waste for everybody. It's an insane policy to play with that option. It should be unthinkable.
Yeah, but that's the problem, George. We have elites thinking the unthinkable.
Yes.
And it's something that, you know, we've all talked about. It's to solve other problems, like the failure of the European Union as a project, George.
Yes, it is. And I think that, the failure and the horror of it would become apparent very quickly. But that's why it's very useful that the EU has already introduced measures to crack down on all expression through social media, through mass media. So whatever disquiet the public will feel will immediately be repressed. I think there will be people will be carted off to jail very, very quickly. Yes. It's not going to be difficult. I don't think there's going to be that much resistance to a mass mobilization with Europe, because the framework for it has already been done. I mean, you see it day after day after day with this crackdown on social media, on media. So,
they just closed your bank account.
That's right.
They closed your bank account.
So I think it wouldn't be that difficult, essentially, to introduce a Europe-wide police state.
And depressing note, gentlemen, we've run out of time. At least we're not talking about Kaya Kallas. I guess that makes her happy. Okay. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Istanbul and in Budapest. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here in RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.